Hello, my name is Philip Mirton, and today we are going to have a conversation beyond science and religion.
Breaking new ground in thinking, exploring the outer limits of what we know about the world and ourselves, unhindered by common beliefs and perceptions. This is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, taking on subjects from the Big Bang, the multiverse, and evolution to the supernatural and the new rising consciousness. This is where scientists, philosophers, New Agers, and spiritualists come together to discuss where this world may be heading. Now, here's your host, lawyer, philosopher, and the author of The Heaven at the End of Science, Philip Mirton.
Now, 2 weeks ago, we had Professor Paul Steinhardt from Princeton University on the show, and we talked about the inflationary Big Bang, and I mentioned on that show the importance of the Big Bang because it is the leading explanation from the scientific perspective of how the universe began, or perhaps, as Mr. Steinhardt said, how the universe cooled and expanded. The problem with the original Big Bang, as we discussed on that show, was that it requires certain fine-tuning of the conditions that ignited the bang. In the place of the original Big Bang, there is another theory. It's called the inflationary Big Bang, started by Alan Guth and developed by others, including Professor Steinhardt. Then Professor Steinhardt came out with an article in the Scientific American about a year ago, raising the question about whether the right kind of inflation necessary to create the universe we live in also would require fine-tuning. This question of fine-tuning is very important in the modern scientific world. Why? Because the more scientists look into the heart of matter, and the more they look out among the galaxies, we start to see things that appear to be finely tuned or adjusted to allow for a stable universe, and more specifically, conditions that allow for life to exist. Now, these fine-tuning elements range from things that may be more mundane, such as maybe the Earth's distance from the Sun, to the number of spatial dimensions, 3 or 4, depending on how you count them, to the critical mass, which is the relationship of the mass density of the universe to the gravitational force, to the strength of dark energy, which is that energy that is accelerating the expansion of the universe, to extremely technical concepts. For example, there's this concept called the N value, the coupling constant, which is the value of the electrical force between atoms divided by the gravitational force. Now, that particular equation, by the way, is something like 10 to the 36th power, and if that value was a little off, then atoms couldn't hold together and apparently we wouldn't be here. Now, there's a lot of books on this topic, the fine-tuning question. Among them would be Paul Davies, who wrote an early book on the topic called The Accidental Universe. There's one by Martin Rees called Just Six Numbers. There's another one called The Nine Numbers of the Cosmos by Michael Rowan Robinson. So the question of the fine-tuning of the universe is something that is intriguing, compelling, and is raising issues in the modern scientific worldview. Not only do we have to explain where these fine-tuning elements came from, but there's a further question about why are they overlapping? Why do they all seem to come together to create the universe we live in? And we may see where this is heading. Faced with the enormity of this mystery, many people would look to theological explanations. In short, they would say, well, God did it. But as other folks have pointed out, this approach leaves God unexplained and seems to replace one giant mystery for another. Another approach, which is quickly gaining support in cosmology, involves something called the multiverse, the amazing idea that there exists not one universe, but a near infinite number of them, each with different physical laws and constants, and maybe an infinite number with different physical laws and constants. And we happen to live in one that just seems finely tuned to us to be here, to allow us to be here. And this is not just some sort of fringe theory. Articles on the multiverse have made their way into the popular media, such as the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and it is a topic of two recent best-selling books, one by Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow called The Grand Design, and the other by Brian Greene called The Hidden Reality. So the topic of today's show is, Is the Multiverse the Final Explanation? And I'm extremely happy to have as our guest today, joining us from the United Kingdom, Professor Bernard Carr. Now, he is a professor of mathematics and astronomy at Queen Mary University of London. His research interests include the early universe, dark matter, and the anthropic principle, which we'll get into. He regularly appears on television, including The Sky at Night and Horizon, and has published many popular scientific articles, as well as roughly 200 technical papers. He's a member of the Royal Astronomical Society and the Institute of Physics. In 1984, he was awarded the Adams Prize by the University of Cambridge, one of the UK's most prestigious mathematical awards. He is also the editor of the book, Universe or Multiverse, which contains contributions from a wide variety of leading thinkers and scientists on the subject of the multiverse. Now, welcome to the show, Professor Carr.
Thank you.
Okay, it's great to have you here. Now, let's start off, for those who are not familiar with the concept of the multiverse, can you explain, and maybe if it's possible in simple terms, what the multiverse is?
Well, I think before explaining what the multiverse is, I'd better start off by explaining what we mean by the universe.
Good idea.
I mean, technically, the universe, if you look it up in the dictionary, means all that exists. And with that definition, you might say there could be nothing beyond the universe. But from a practical point of view, that is not a very useful definition. And when cosmologists talk about the universe, what they normally mean is the maximum distance we can see. The point being that if the universe began with a Big Bang about 14 billion years ago, then light can only have traveled roughly 14 billion light years. Actually, it's something like three times that because of the expansion of the universe. But the point is there's a maximum distance to which you can see. And from a practical point of view, it is convenient to regard that in some sense as our universe. But the point is, there's no reason to believe that the universe itself actually doesn't exist beyond that. So there's no reason that the galaxies shouldn't continue to exist way beyond the extent to which we can see. It's rather like if you're looking at the ocean from the mast of a boat, you can only see 30 miles, but no one denies that the ocean goes on beyond that.
Yeah. Before you go on, I just want to clarify something, and this is very helpful. And just because if we say that the universe began, the Big Bang began 14 billion years ago, and then you measure the rate at which light could have traveled in 14 billion years, and so that would lead to 14 billion light years. But then you said that with the expansion, the number is actually three times that, and again, that's sort of the number that I've seen out there, something like 40 billion light years.
But the reason for that is that because the universe is expanding, space itself is expanding, okay. The light gets carried along by that expansion. Okay. And it's just a rather simple calculation to show that the actual distance light travels is something like three times the naive estimate of the age of the universe times the speed of light. Right. So that corresponds to something like 40 million light years as opposed to 14 million light years.
Right. And what I was going to ask is, how would somebody know that the actual one universe we know about is bigger than 40 billion light years?
Well, what I'm saying is you wouldn't know from direct observation, just as you couldn't from direct observation from a top of a mast on a ship, say the ocean, extended beyond 30 miles. Okay. It's just it is by far the most natural inference. Okay. The point is that the longer we wait, the more of the universe we can see, because light can travel further. And there's no evidence, certainly in the history of astronomy, that the universe, we suddenly stop seeing more galaxies as we look further. So there's no doubt that one expects the universe or the distribution of galaxies to extend beyond what we call the observable universe.
Okay.
But the point I want to make is that that's only one simple type of multiverse. You might say that the fact that there are domains which are beyond the ones we can observe is a type of universe. And in fact, Max Tegmark calls that the level one multiverse, which in some sense is rather trivial, and I don't think many cosmologists would actually dispute that. You get into sort of difficult problems if the universe goes on for infinity. You know, you discover that there can be another Bernard Carr in another universe who's just like me, except he's dressed differently. So you get into all sorts of philosophical problems if the universe extends too far, but at least at some level it's very natural to assume that the universe does extend beyond the visible domain. But the point is, and this is really where the controversy becomes more interesting, the multiverse isn't just talking about this level one variety. The problem is this, that when cosmologists try and speculate about how the universe actually originated, you essentially are claiming that physics has a mechanism for generating universes. Now, it used to be said that, you know, that was beyond physics, because when you go back to the beginning of the universe, all physical laws break down. But now cosmologists, because of developments in quantum gravity, etc., think they can understand, perhaps, the physics which generated the universe. And the problem is that if you've got a mechanism for generating one universe, for one Big Bang, in principle, that same mechanism could produce many other Big Bangs. And so the second more exciting possibility is that actually there are many other universes, there are many other Big Bangs besides our own. And that's what might be called the level two multiverse. So it's the idea that there are not just regions beyond our horizon, our observable horizon, but that there are actually different universes. And when people talk about the multiverse, they're normally talking about that rather more exciting level two variety.
I think the contrast that I think you're making is that, and that I've seen in the literature, is that this level one or this idea that what we observe in the one universe may not be the full extent of our universe, that in that particular universe, though, in our particular universe, you would expect the physical laws and constants to be the same.
That's right.
But when you move to the multiple bangs...
That is correct, okay. Because if so long as you're looking at the level one multiverse, which is in some sense just a natural extrapolation of the nice universe we observe, it's not clear that you're going to get any variations in the constants of physics, for example, which you referred to in your introduction, which is why that version of the multiverse is not so interesting.
Right.
On the other hand, when you talk about the level two multiverse, the different Big Bangs, then there is no reason why the constants of nature should be the same in the different Big Bangs. So really, it's that second version which brings in the link between the fine tunings of the constants.
Right, right. And I think that is the amazing and, as you say, the interesting part of the multiverse.
Absolutely.
Because you have to, and there's so many different angles one could take on this concept, but one angle of approach is that in order to lead to a universe with different physical laws and constants, it needs to be, in some ways, isolated from ours, or it needs to be a separate entity, a separate category of conditions. And to me, it's interesting. It's also pretty wild because you're imagining that there is a whole nother bubble out there that is, in some ways, it has to be isolated, one would think, because it's a different world.
Well, when you say another bubble, I mean, first of all, the word bubble is sort of one particular variant of the multiverse. But
right.
But whatever variant you're using, of course, it's not just one bubble. You're going to need a huge number of bubbles for this to be a natural explanation of the fine tuning. So when we invoke a multiverse, we're not just saying there's another bubble out there. They're saying there's a huge number of other bubbles.
Right, right. And that's right.
Not necessarily infinite, but at least a large number of bubbles. And you raised the question of the fine tunings, which is really crucial, because the point is that we cannot directly see these other universes. And for that reason, some people say it doesn't count as science, because if you can't see it, how can it be science? But the point is that the reason one of the strongest arguments for invoking these other universes is that they provide a natural way to explain the fine tunings. So you might regard the fine tunings as a sort of indirect evidence for these other universes, even if you can't see them directly. Now, that still leaves it somewhat on the domain of science and philosophy, because you're still not seeing them directly, but at least it's a sort of logical argument for why such other worlds might exist.
Yeah, and that in itself, the natural explanation, is again a rich topic, because there are some people who would say that it doesn't seem very natural to me to imagine a 10 to the 500 different bubble universes. But that's sort of something I want to hold for a moment. Someone might say, well, what led to the development of this idea? Where did it come from?
Okay. It's arisen, I would say, independently from two different directions. The concept of the multiverse has developed as a result of astronomical observations and as a result of developments in cosmology, but it's also developed as a result of developments in particle physics. And what's exciting is that in some sense these two approaches have now converged. And I would say it's the convergence of these two approaches which has really caused all the excitement, and which has really caused a big change in the status of the multiverse. Because, you know, if you go back only 20 years ago, when, you know, myself and Martin Rees were putting these arguments about the fine-tuning requiring a multiverse 20 years ago, but in those days, it was a very heretical idea. And most people were very skeptical about it. Now, a mere 20 years later, I won't say everybody believes it, because it's still very controversial, but I would say at least a sizable fraction of cosmologists and particle physicists take the idea seriously. So now maybe it would be helpful if I sketch briefly the sort of ways in which cosmology and particle physics has led to the idea of a multiverse.
Yeah, I think that would be good.
Okay. Well, I mean, first of all, well, let's start with the cosmological approach. As I said, the big question has always been, how do we explain the Big Bang? How do we explain the origin of the universe? Now, one possible explanation is that the universe, the Big Bang, was preceded by a collapsing phase. It's this idea of a bouncing universe, a cyclic model which goes through periods of expansion and recollapse. It then bounces, expands, and recollapses, and so on. So that's a quite an old idea. It goes back about 80 years. So one possibility is that the universe simply bounced, and these different phases, these different cycles of the bouncing universe, allow you to have different constants and things like that. But the more topical approach is the inflationary scenario, which, of course, you spoke about to Paul Steinhardt. Now, the point about the inflationary scenario, it does explain a lot of riddles associated with the standard Big Bang without inflation. But one of the key features of inflation is that it does predict that our universe, our visible universe, if you like, is just part of a bubble. And that bubble itself may just be one of many, many other bubbles which are all predicted by this inflationary theory. So inflation is a natural way in which you can produce these different universes. And probably that is the approach which has attracted most interest, simply because most cosmologists now do take the inflationary scenario very seriously. Now, that in normal inflation, you simply can think of having lots of the bubbles spread out in space, whereas in the cyclic model I refer to, it's like lots of universes spread out in time. But there's another version of inflation which is called eternal inflation, which is a little bit more complicated. And in eternal inflation, these bubbles are in some sense spread out in space and time. But that's maybe a bit too technical for the discussion. But I would say inflation in its various forms is probably the primary motivating factor. But it's not the only one. Another setting for the multiverse comes from quantum cosmology. We know that the laws of relativity break down at the very beginning of the universe, technically at 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the Big Bang, which is a very tiny time, but we know that the laws of physics of relativity must break down. But in quantum cosmology, you're able to describe that process. And quantum cosmology now is able to talk about the possible existence of many different universes. So quantum cosmology also allows a setting for the multiverse. So those, if you like, are the three scenarios which arise out of normal cosmology for the multiverse: the oscillating models, the inflationary models, and the quantum cosmology models.
Okay.
Now I'll move on to particle physics. One of the key aims of particle physics, of course, is to have a final theory of everything which unifies all the forces of nature. And I guess the favorite at the moment is so-called M theory, and I expect you've spoken about that on previous programs.
Right.
One of the interesting things about M theory is that it predicts that there are many different possible vacuum states. It doesn't, originally it was hoped that M theory would uniquely predict the state of the universe and the state of the constants. That hope has not been fulfilled, and it now looks as though M theory may actually predict a huge number of different universes, or vacuum states as we call it. This is where this number 10 to the 500 comes from. Now, of course, to some people that's a disappointment, but if it is true that M theory is predicting all these different universes, then all these different universes or vacuum states should actually exist. And in each of these universes, you could have different constants. So you have a very natural setting for the sort of multiverse scenario which is invoked to explain the fine tunings. So, and it's because, of course, so many particle physicists are interested in M theory, that those particle physicists, people like Steven Weinberg, have also got very interested in the idea of the multiverse. What's particularly exciting, of course, is that cosmologists have discovered relatively recently that the universe is accelerating, and we think that means that there must be some cosmological constant, so-called, which is driving this expansion, this accelerated expansion.
Yeah.
And
go ahead.
And the point about that cosmological constant is precisely what is being described in these different vacuum states of the M theory. It's what we call the string landscape scenario. So I would say that is the one of the approaches from particle physics which has made the multiverse popular.
Yeah. Now let me try to put this in context a little bit and play the role of a skeptic, but more of someone that is trying to get the listeners to understand how controversial this topic is, but also how interesting it is. And for example, M theory, which Professor Carr just mentioned, is actually the topic of the book The Grand Design, which I think sold a million plus copies. And so Stephen Hawking did a service by bringing this concept to the public, and we don't have time here to talk about it. But I think it's like a collection of string theories. Is that what M theory is? It's some kind of amalgamation of different string theories.
Yes, the original string theory. I mean, superstring theory took off really in 1984. And it was hoped this would be the final theory. But it turned out that there wasn't one superstring theory. There were actually, I think, five of these theories. And so there wasn't a unique theory. And these string theory involved 10 dimensions in total. So there was three space, one time. And then these other there was the other six dimensions to make up the 10. But then it was discovered about 10 years later that there was a more embracing theory called M theory, which actually accommodates all of those different versions of superstring theory.
Yeah.
And that's got 11 dimensions, so there's one extra dimension. And that's the theory which most particle physicists are now so excited about.
Yeah, and this is going to be a slight detour, but I think it's important. And that is, if I understand this correctly, the string theorists in the last decade or two were hopeful that there would be a string theory, one theory, that they could devise to explain the standard model, or to explain the strength of the particles and forces. And as they were going along, it turned out that there were multiple variations of string theory. And this is where the 10 to the 500 comes in?
Well, I would put it slightly differently. Okay. I mean, the point was there were different variations. In the context of superstring theory, it was known there were five different theories,
right,
which
right.
were sort of amalgamated by M theory. But the hope was that M theory itself might give a unique universe. But it's M theory itself which has failed to actually produce the unique theory. So the 10 to the 500 vacuum states is really associated with M theory.
Okay. So, but the point I want to make here for the listeners, how interesting this is, and that is, the M theory in the book The Grand Design should be contrasted with critics of string theory. And one book that I would suggest here, it's called The Trouble with Physics by Lee Smolin. And there's another book called Not Even Wrong, whose author's name I think it's Volt.
Yes.
But those two books are highly critical of string theory and basically say the string theory is not science or is borderline science because it can't be tested. Okay. So there's an interesting debate on the legitimacy of string theory itself, which would be your one line of your convergence. Then on the other side, on the inflationary Big Bang model, as I mentioned, Paul Steinhardt and others are skeptical of the inflationary Big Bang. And I think Stephen Hawking isn't exactly a big fan of it either, if I remember correctly. But the point here is that this is a very intriguing debate going on in cosmology right now, because it shows sort of to me the scientific method or the scientific enterprise in process, because you have some really deep, big and experienced thinkers here trying to figure it out and taking different sides of the debate. And it's sort of like going through this long gauntlet of debate and discourse, trying to figure out what the best argument is to explain, at the end of the day, I think, the fine-tuning problem. So I mean, that's I think from a purely sort of understand the debate topic, yeah, I think it's good to read a couple of these different books and see the different sides of the argument. And I want to add for that, and I didn't do this to give Professor Carr's book sort of a plug here, but his book Universe or Multiverse does contain, I think, really a good debate on this topic. Okay, so we have. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So I would like to react to that. I mean, as you say, the book does try and present both sides. But, I mean, you've made a very good point, which I would also like to reiterate, which is that all of these ideas are controversial, and it's not as though everyone accepts them. In fact, of course, there's a huge controversy within particle physics about whether M-theory qualifies as physics. Is it physics, or is it mathematics, or is it just metaphysics? And, in fact, that merely mirrors the whole controversy about whether the multiverse is physics or mathematics or metaphysics.
Right.
Because
right.
essentially these two ideas are intimately linked, and there is an argument that both the multiverse and M theory aren't what we would traditionally regard as standard physics. People like me who are enthusiastic about them say, well, that's true, but the whole point about science is that the nature of science does change, and if you're going to regard the multiverse on the one hand and M-theory on the other hand as going to be science, you have to in some sense loosen your definition of what science is. I mean, the basic problem in both cases, with both the multiverse and the M-theory, is that we don't as yet have direct evidence that the other universes exist or that the other dimensions, etc., exist. Now, it may be, the hope is, that there will be observational developments on both sides which will give direct evidence for the multiverse and M theory. But Nevertheless, it's possible that that evidence won't come, or at least it won't come on a timescale which is of interest to us, like 100 years. And then there is a legitimate debate about to what extent you regard this as a serious scientific speculation.
Well, I want to add here to your point that on the bigger level, one thing that comes across in this show is that there is a bigger convergence going on, at least in the debate. Because, you know, I have a philosophy background, as I think I've mentioned in the past, and I view a lot of the scientific writing on this topic, and your book is a good example, and I think almost any of the popular science books which we've mentioned, such as The Hidden Reality, The Grand Design, The Trouble with Physics, there is a lot of reasoning in there. And I don't know if I would call it metaphysics, although some of it is definitely metaphysics. But you have scientists who are really practicing philosophical reasoning. And there's nothing wrong with it. I'm not saying there's anything wrong because I don't think people should be pigeonholed. But then you have, on the other side of the equation, you have others, and an example would be Lynn McTaggart, who are on the, I don't know what category to put her into, maybe the new science, new spirituality, whatever, who are discussing the scientific findings from a different perspective. And that to me is what is extremely interesting, because my core belief is that if there is a final theory, it's got to be a final theory for everybody. It can't just make, and there's no offense here, but it can't just make the professors happy. It's got to make everybody happy, because it's like the law of gravity. Nobody disputes the law of gravity. And if there is an explanation for the fine tuning, then it needs to be something that is valid scientifically and therefore is accepted by everybody. So I just wanted to make that point. Again, to me, that's a very interesting component of this debate, is just the different people trying to figure it out from different perspectives. And I hope that there is going to be overall a convergence towards one theory.
Well, that's true. And of course, it's trying to make a physicist happy about the multiverse is very different from trying to make a philosopher happy about the multiverse, or very different from trying to make a theologian happy about the multiverse. I'm afraid I don't know enough about Lynn McTaggart's work to know what will make her happy, but of course it is true that different people will be satisfied in different ways. What is undoubtedly true, though, is that there is a huge interest, not just from the physicists, but from the broader public in these sorts of issues, because it really is, you know, we're asking the most fundamental questions about the nature of the universe, how it began, and about our role in the universe as intelligent, conscious beings. And so I think it's not surprising that everybody is interested in, or many people are interested in these sorts of questions. And, you know, the question of whether it's science is, in some sense, that's a secondary issue. I mean, I have to say that from my perspective, the issue is not so much whether there is a multiverse. I mean, there's so many versions of the multiverse. I mean, you might say the question is not whether there's a multiverse, but how many different types of multiverse there are. But to me, perhaps the more significant question is not whether there's a multiverse, but whether such speculations are actually part of science. And of course, that's an issue you yourself have just raised. And to me, that's what the really interesting dilemma is, because, I mean, I do believe that these, you know, there's a good reason to think these other universes might exist, because they're predicted by these theories. And of course, the theories themselves might be subject to the criticism that they're not proper science. But nevertheless, I personally would lay odds that such multiverses should exist. But what is not trivial is whether or not you should regard this as part of physics or metaphysics.
Yeah, okay, and I think that's a very, very good point to make. And it's something that is discussed in a number of articles and books, and I think it's really good that you raise that front and center, specifically whether the multiverse is a metaphysical question or a scientific question. Now, let's hold that for a second, because I want to connect the multiverse to the anthropic principle, because this is another sort of very intriguing principle, and it is related to the multiverse, I think. But, and I know you've done a lot of work on the anthropic principle, so can you try to describe what the anthropic principle is?
Indeed. Well, the original anthropic principle, I mean, goes back probably to the 1960s, where it was realized that certain features of the universe, the physical universe, seem to have to be the way they are, because otherwise we wouldn't be here asking questions about it. Now, and this was called by Brandon Carter the anthropic principle. Anthropic is the Greek word for man. Now, actually, it's a terrible choice of word, because whatever the anthropic principle is, it isn't really to do with human beings in particular. It's really just saying that you have certain fine-tunings which are necessary for any form of complexity to arise at all. So it's not as though it's specific to Homo sapiens. But nevertheless, we are stuck with this word anthropic, and so we use it, but with that caveat borne in mind. Well, what are these fine-tunings? Well, traditionally, we make a distinction between what is called the weak anthropic principle and the strong anthropic principle. So if I may, I'll just spend a little time making that distinction.
That's good.
One of the most straightforward anthropic arguments is simply to ask, why is the size of the universe roughly 10 billion light years? Now, you might just say, well, it's just an accident. It just happens to be that size. But Robert Dickey gave an argument in the 1960s, which was much more interesting. Dickey said the size of the universe, first of all, is determined by the age of the universe, which is roughly 10 billion years. I mean, now we know it's more precisely closer to 14 billion, but roughly speaking, 10 billion years. And so then you have to say, well, why is the universe roughly 10 billion years old when we're looking at it? Well, what Dickey said was, he says, the reason is this. In order for life to exist, you have to have complex chemistry, you have to have things, elements like carbon. Those elements can only be produced in stars, so stars have to have gone through their evolution and exploded a supernova so that these elements which have been made in the star can be disseminated through space, where they eventually get incorporated into planets and people. But the trouble is that takes, for the stars to go all through their evolution, takes several billion years anyway. On the other hand, you can't wait too much longer than that, because if you do, all the matter in the universe will have been processed through stars and you'll just have dead stellar remnants and black holes. So Dickey said there is a little window of time, roughly 10 billion years, where life can exist. And so he says the reason the universe is 10 billion light years in size is simply because we can, as intelligent beings, can only be observing it when the universe is roughly 10 billion years old. It's not saying the universe can't exist apart from that time. It's just saying that we could not be here asking questions about it unless it was roughly 10 billion years old. Now, that's called a weak anthropic argument, because it's just accepting that the universe exists with all its constants and laws of nature, but that there is a selection effect which determines when we can be looking at the universe. It's no different from saying there's a selection effect which says that intelligent beings probably have to live quite close to a star in order to be around. So that's a selection effect about on where you live, close to a star, as opposed to a selection effect about when you live, which was Dickey's argument. So in some sense, those arguments are well accepted. They're not even controversial. It's just saying our presence as observers does impose a selection effect on when and where we observe the universe. Now, much more interesting are what one might call the strong anthropic arguments. And they say that the constants of nature themselves, and also things like the values of various cosmological parameters, must also be fine-tuned in order to explain why we are here. Now, in order to to describe those coincidences, again, I have to review a number of little arguments, which I'll try and do briefly. First of all, we know that the various forces in nature, there are four forces, the electric, the weak, the gravitational, and the strong forces, and they're all described by a number, a dimensionless coupling constant, which basically describes how strong those forces are. But the theory of physics we have at the moment does not explain why these coupling constants have the values they do. So despite the hope of M-theory that it would uniquely predict the coupling constants, it's not succeeded. In fact, we don't even know in terms of theory what is the relationship between these different constants. But what we do know is that if these constants did not have values which were pretty close to the values which were observed, then we would not exist. Now, when I say we would not exist, what I mean is, there wouldn't be stars and galaxies, there wouldn't be the variety of chemical elements which is necessary for life. And so those are the fine-tuning arguments. Now, if you ask what these fine-tuning arguments are involving these coupling constants, that itself could be quite a long discussion. But let me just say, for example, there's constants associated, the relationships between the electric fine constant and the gravitational fine structure constant, which are required for the existence of stars. You actually refer to this implicitly in your introduction when you refer to the ratio between the electric and the gravitational force between two protons. You recall you mentioned that was something like 10 to the 36.
Right.
Well, that is precisely, the question is, why is that ratio so huge? In other words, why is the force between the electric force between two protons so much greater by 10 to the 36 or so than the electric force between, than the gravitational force between two protons? Right. And the point is, conventional physics doesn't answer that.
Right.
However, what we do know is that unless there was a very fine tuning between the value of the electric fine structure constant and the gravitational fine structure constant, then we wouldn't have, we wouldn't be here, and stars wouldn't be here. And the arguments for that are a little bit technical, but let me just say, for example, that the reason, for example, when a star explodes as a supernova, that is because when it collapses, the temperature gets very hot in the core and you produce these neutrinos. Those neutrinos then propagate through the star and they eject the surface of the star. Now, if that ejection occurs through the weak interaction, the interaction between the neutrinos and the protons in the star, if the weak interaction was too small, too weak, the neutrinos would go straight through the surface and there would be no explosion. If it was too strong, then the neutrinos would be trapped in the core. And it's only because there is a very fine tuning between the weak strength and the gravitational strength that the supernova occurs at all. Now, that tuning is observed, but it is not predicted by any theory of physics. An even more remarkable fine tuning relates to the ratio of the gravitational and the electric fine structure constants, which I referred to earlier. And that's a little bit too technical to go into, but it's essentially related to the fact that there are two types of stars, one in which what we think of as convective and radiative stars. This is describing the way in which the heat essentially gets out from the core, where it's generated by nuclear reaction, to the surface. For some stars, the heat gets out through radiation. Through other stars, it gets out through convective processes. And you actually need both types of process, both types of stars, in order for life to exist.
You know, I think based upon what you just summarized, we could see why cosmologists are getting into the area of metaphysics or philosophy or reasoning, whatever term we're going to use, because this shows that the deeper science has looked into the elements of our universe, into the very small and into the very large, we're finding parameters that have to be in a very narrow range in order for the universe to remain stable and life to exist. And so this finding leads to questions, it leads to self-critical examination of theories, and it leads to things like the multiverse, because what seems to me to be the case is that a theory would be nice if the quote-unquote final theory did explain why these values are necessary, right? I mean, and the problem here, to me, among others, is that the more values you have, the more of these fine-tuning examples there are, the more difficult it is to imagine that they were actually finely tuned. It becomes more and more improbable, and I want to raise something here that I think is very problematic from the multiverse perspective and from the fine tuning perspective, and that is when I read about the fine tuning issues, I see that the scientists are trying to explain a mosaic, a still picture. They're trying to say, well, we know what the observed values are, and let's put them all together and let's try to figure out how they turned out to be finely tuned. But we don't live in a two-dimensional mosaic. We live in a three-dimensional action movie. I don't see any of these theories explaining the smooth movement of reality, the way it all fits together and moves. It's one thing to say, to come up with instances where you're playing a computer game and now you adjust the parameters and out pops a model, but that's one thing. But to explain the three-dimensional flowing movement of reality is a whole other thing, and so I'm not completely convinced that the analysis has really recognized the depth of the mystery.
Well, I would say your question has really moved the discussion into a much broader and, I would say, more interesting domain, which does indeed go beyond the anthropic principle. When you talk about why is the universe able to produce this, I think you said, three-dimensional flow or whatever, you're really, I think, referring to the much more deeper question of why are we here observing the universe at all? Why are we experiencing the flow of time? Right. What, for example, is the role of consciousness in this universe? Right. Now, that's a much broader question than the question of these anthropic fine-tunings. You're asking a question, I think, I mean, maybe you weren't intentionally, but to me, you're asking a question which is the deeper question of what is the role of consciousness and experience in the universe? Now, all I would say is, that's a broader question, but I would say the question of the fine tunings is in some sense a smaller but necessary part of that question, because yes. Until you've got these anthropic fine tunings sorted out, you can't even begin to go and ask the broader question about this, the flow the flow of experience which you're referring to. Yes. And so, going back to your original remark about physics and metaphysics, I would say that the actual existence of these fine tunings, in other words, the existence of a problem to be explained, I tend to think of that as part of the physics. I mean, there is no doubt that you can do physical calculations to see what would a star be like if you changed the values of the coupling constants, and would it explode? Would you have the sort of stars you like? Would you have the rich array of chemistry if you changed the value of the strong constant exactly? To me, that's a physical question, and indeed, it, you can do a physical calculation. Where it merges into metaphysics is when you then get down to the question of, well, what is the basis of these fine tunings? What is the explanation of the fine tunings?
Yeah.
So really, your comment to me has sort of, it's opened up two important points.
Yeah, and I want to, just to be as clear as possible, there's at least two different parts of a fundamental constant to me, there's the question of why is the constant the value it is? For example, this fine structure constant, or the critical density, or the carbon issue that Fred Hoyle, you know, okay, why is it that constant? But then the second question is, why does it remain constant? What holds it together over time? What locks it in? And that's sort of what I would say. Now I want to make this other point, which is that I think a large problem, and this is, I'm going to be a little facetious with it, and this is sort of unfair, I'm going to be a little facetious, but a problem I have with some of the science books is that they have not read Kant, particularly the Critique of Pure Reason. Now, this particular book is really, it's hard to read, and it's in some ways it's esoteric, and most people probably, you know, Kant is quoted a lot for various things, for morals and for, I think he came up with the island universe concept, and he has certain scientific breakthroughs as well. But he was primarily a metaphysician. And he said, for example, that space or three-dimensional space is a form of the intuition, which he meant was a necessary part of the mind. He said the mind cannot experience reality other than in three dimensions because the mind imposes that structure upon reality. And so my problem with some of the multiverse reasoning and speculation is that they need to read Kant a little bit and see maybe this, some of this consciousness itself is imposing upon reality, because Kant was no lightweight. He's definitely the top five philosopher of all time, and some people would put him number one with Plato. So it's something that I think is extremely important. I mentioned earlier about the convergence of thinking on this, and this is sort of what I'm saying is that when the scientists become philosophers, the philosophers start becoming scientists, and maybe people meet in the middle somewhere. We don't have enough time really to develop this this very interesting topic more. We have definitely touched on a lot of the aspects of this idea, but I want to ask you one last question. And that is, do you think that the multiverse is the final answer to explain the fine-tuning of the universe?
Well, I mean, first of all, let me just remark about Kant. I'm sure you're right, most cosmologists don't read Kant. I know you're also right that Kant was a great philosopher. He was philosophy just as Weinberg and Hawking are to physics, etc. And I might also point out that Kant was also made a big contribution. He was one of the first people to speculate about galaxies outside our own galaxy.
Yeah.
However, I think the sort of particular issues you were addressing, you know, are again more related to the question of how does the role of mind in our conscience and it's the relationship between mind and reality, which again I would say goes a little bit beyond the sort of issues which most cosmologists are talking about when they talk about the multiverse. I mean, right. You talked about Kant's ideas and three dimensions, but of course physicists now tell us that there's not just three dimensions, but there are all these extra dimensions, 11 dimensions or whatever you're going to believe. And so you might ask, well, how do Kant's ideas apply to that?
Right.
Because the point to those sorts of concepts. So I would say if Kant was alive today, he would be asking, well, can I apply my ideas about the nature of space and time to these extra dimensions as well?
Yeah.
But now let's go back to the question you asked me originally about, do I think that the multiverse is the ultimate explanation? Well, of course, I don't know. But let me just say this. I would always hope that there would be eventually direct evidence for the multiverse. And what do I mean by that? Well, for example, it is conceivable that even though we can't see these other universes, these other bubbles, there might be indirect evidence. For example, it may be that there were collisions in early in the history of our universe between these different bubbles. And in that case, you would be able to see sort of scars in the background sky, in the background cosmic radiation, for example, which would be a signature of those collisions. And people are actively looking now to see if there is any evidence for such collisions. They haven't found it, but at least in principle, they can look for it. So I do think it's conceivable that there might be direct evidence for these other universes, just as I think it's conceivable there might be direct evidence for M-theory. Maybe they would find extra dimensions, evidence for extra dimensions from the Large Hadron Collider. But let's assume the worst-case scenario, which that doesn't happen. Well, then I would say the best evidence for the multiverse is, in fact, the evidence from fine-tuning. Because simply, I feel that is a problem it's been screaming out to us for the last 30 years, and somehow it's got to have a solution. Now, it seems to me that there are only two solutions. Well, not only two, but the two most rational explanations are either that somebody fine-tuned the universe for our benefit, and of course that's the theological explanation, or you simply say there are lots and lots of universes and it's just a selection effect which says that we have to be in one of the subset of universes which allows us to be here. Now, most physicists, that's to say most physicists who are keen on the multiverse, take that second view. People like Steven Weinberg and Martin Rees are keen on the multiverse precisely because it gets away from a sort of theological explanation. Precisely because you don't have to say, I need a fine tuner. It is naturally explained as a selection effect if you do have all these other universes. And I always give the analogy of a lottery ticket. If you buy a lottery ticket and you win $1 million, at first you might say, wow, I am really gifted by God or whatever. I've been very fortunate. I've won $1 million. I am special. But you know actually that the reason is that there were 1 million other people who bought a lottery ticket. And that's the reason why that's the only reason you've won, because there are lots of other people who didn't win. And to me, the multiverse is like that. If we are the only universe, then you have to think, wow, there's a major problem. How come I've won the lottery? If you accept that there are millions of other universes out there, there's nothing to explain. It is a natural explanation. But of course, it isn't proof that this is the explanation of the fine tunings, but it simply seems to be, as far as I can see, the most rational explanation for why these fine tunings can come about. Now, of course, people can argue about really how significant these fine tunings are. They can say, well, maybe we're too conservative in trying to work out the probability of life. And that may be true, because we don't really know how finely tuned the constants have to be for life to arise. We know that life is very resilient, and you might think life would never arise in certain places in the world, and it somehow manages to arise here on Earth. Maybe the universe is more resilient than we think, and maybe even if the constants weren't quite right, life would still arise. My own view is that if you imagine a space, a parameter space of all the constants, it seems to me clear that there are only certain regions within that space where, let's say, complexity can arise. And as I say, it's complexity which is the crucial thing. We talk about a pyramid of complexity that evolves after the Big Bang, and our living beings are just a sort of culmination of that complexity. Now, it seems to me clear that there are only very small regions within this parameter space where pyramids of complexity can arise. But nevertheless, it may be we are over-conservative in saying just how small these little regions have to be. But nevertheless, I would bet that they have to be relatively small compared to the full possible parameter space. Yeah. And so because of that, my tendency is to say that the multiverse is the best explanation of the fine-tunings in the absence of any direct evidence for these other universes. Yeah, but I think it's very, you know, scientists will sometimes say it can't be science because we can't actually see the other multiverses. But that's not new. I mean, there are all sorts of ideas in physics where you can't verify all aspects of it. I mean, for example, the whole theory of quarks, no one by definition can ever see an isolated quark. That's a prediction of quantum chromodynamics. But nevertheless, we accept the theory because its other predictions work out. No one can see inside a black hole and come out again by the very nature of a black hole. But that doesn't mean people say, therefore, a black hole isn't part of physics. The point is that no one ever said that every aspect of a theory has got to be observable. You merely need to have some aspects of a theory to be observable for you to decide it's plausible. And it's like that with the multiverse. No one is saying that whichever theory is producing the multiverse, no one is saying that you're going to have to verify every aspect, every prediction of the theory. You just have to be able to verify enough of the predictions to make it plausible.
And I have to make two points. First, one of my complaints about some of the modern science perspective on the multiverse and other theories is that they tend to put up the fundamentalist religions as being the straw man, as if that's the opponent, and they tend to think that it's either science or like the multiverse string theory, the inflationary Big Bang, or it's the old man with the beard in heaven, and therefore there's no debate on that one because the concept that there's an old man with a beard in heaven sounds so mythical. But I think that religion and really spirituality, and even that's not a good word, maybe philosophy, metaphysics, has evolved to the point where there's other perspectives on it. And I think Kant would be one of the founders of that. Now, we don't have time to get into this right now, but I just want to say that's one of my complaints, is this either or dichotomy that's set up where it's not, it may not, that may not be the right dichotomy. There might be a third or fourth choice out there.
Can I say I share your complaint, because I am actually interested in the dialogue between science and religion. And you do very much see this presented, this issue of the fine tuning, as presented as a God versus multiverse debate.
Right.
Either God fine-tuned the constants for us to be there, or there's a multiverse, millions of universes, and that explains why we happen to be in the sort of universe required for us to be here. Now, I have to say, I regard that dichotomy as naive. For example, if you want to believe that God created the universe, I see no reason why God couldn't have created the multiverse.
Right.
To me, it's perfectly rational to say, I regard, actually, if one were able to prove the existence of the multiverse in some way, I would say that was more or less neutral as to whether or not God existed. It could go either way. But the big difference is that if there was only one universe, then I would say you then may have a problem, because if there's only one universe, there really does seem to be fine-tuning. And so there's obviously a danger that the theologian is going to come along, or the fundamentalist is going to come along and say, therefore you need God.
Right.
And that's why I think it was Neil Manson said that the multiverse was the last resort of the desperate atheist.
Yeah.
Because if there really is only one universe, then you may be forced to say there has to be a fine tuner. If there is a multiverse, in some sense, it could go either way, which from my perspective is actually a happier state of affairs, because I'm interested in the debate between science and religion.
Yeah,
so I think you're quite right to say it's not an either or.
Yeah, and I think it happens. It just, and part of it is the media, and it's really prevalent in the Darwin versus intelligent design debate, where there's only two choices. I tell people all the time, well, I don't think it's a multiple choice exam, nor do I don't think there's only two choices in the exam. It's as if there's not any other narrative, any other story theory out there that transcends both. Now, it's time to bring us to an end. We've left a lot of issues sort of unexplored, but in concluding, I just want to say that science seeks to explain the world we live in, and this universe we know has special conditions that are suited for life. The more we look, the more special the conditions appear. But science itself does not seem to want to resort to the supernatural to explain these circumstances, so many cosmologists are gravitating towards the multiverse. But whether this explanation is convincing, and whether it advances our state of knowledge or is simply a placeholder until something better comes along, remains to be seen. We know that in the end, the mystery remains. This is Philip Mirotin, and this is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion.
You've been listening to Conversations Beyond Science and Religion with Philip Mirotin. To find out more about Philip and his new book, The Heaven at the End of Science, visit heavenattheendofscience.com.